This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet fuel.
I expect, and I already see the beginnings of it, that 2021 will be the strongest year of growth the PR industry has ever experienced around the world, and that lots of the trends of being more strategic, digital, just rocketing, more PR people providing advice before decisions are taken to chief execs, all of that will stay.
Welcome to Fuel, the new business podcast, and I'm your host, a Smith called Keith. In this edition of the Fuel podcast, we look at the public relations industry, and who better to discuss this with than a man who's been credited with turning around the fortunes of the PR industry trade body, the PRCA, the Public Relations and Communications Association, and that's Francis Ingham. He very graciously set some time aside to sit down with me to discuss the freshly changed landscape of the PR industry and the challenges it now faces as it adapts to a new way of working and winning new business. Prospecting for new business is hard at the best of times, and it certainly helps if you can take a lot of the background research and intelligence gathering out of the equation, so you've got more time to work on the actual job of finding new clients. Our sponsor, The Advertist, is a SaaS platform that allows you to match the latest agency new business opportunities with a massive database of contacts, tenders, people moves, mergers and acquisitions, crowdfunding, MBOs, and IPOs. If you want to increase your new business prospecting efficiency, then give the team a call at The Advertist on 0203 356 3717 or email hello@theadvertist.com. Now, before we proceed to the main course, here's a little amuse-bouche on the subject of agility from a man who's no stranger to being flexible himself, Mr. Jeremy Davis.
Jeremy Davis! New business trailblazer!
There have been a few posts doing the rounds on social media lately regarding terms and phrases agencies should never use in their credentials. Strategic was one, in many cases, promising a lot more than it delivers, suggestive of some wizened general standing atop the mountain of market dominance, surveying all of the competing factors below, and making a detailed plan for achieving total victory. Whereas we all know that what it really means is that you formalised, or rather post-rationalised, your creative process into a handy visual format and stuck a TM on it. And we'll charge the client extra for the inclusion of a couple of graphs featuring some numbers on market share you found in a free report published last Christmas. Integrated was another term derided for being overused and essentially meaningless in these days of multi-channel branding. Like the term full service, it started out as something impressive sounding and innovative in the days when creative and media, or print and digital, tended to be run through different agencies. But these days it really just fills some space without doing or meaning anything important. A little bit like Olives or the Shadow Cabinet. It doesn't mean much more than you've got an open-plan office and people actually talk to one another. One term I've not seen mentioned, but I believe belongs on this list, is agile. Now, this one is actually slightly more meaningful than the aforementioned terms, which hark back to the 20th century and should have been left there. The dictionary definition of agile is can move quickly and easily, and in my youth, speaking of the 20th century, it was a physical attribute. Goalkeepers were agile, and so was Batman. If the agile creative team does not save penalties or fight crime in a spandex onesie, perhaps it suggests that the creative team can somersault over the water cooler and land on one leg. In modern times, of course, the concept of agile has emerged as a grown-up business philosophy, with pages of academic text devoted to agile business processes, expensively designed to enable the organisation to respond quickly to market changes, and even applied to specific disciplines such as IT, where it refers, according to one website I came across, to software development methodologies centred around the idea of iterative development, where requirements and solutions evolve through collaboration between self-organising cross-functional teams. Which sounds very impressive. In an agency context, it's not quite this thought through. It essentially means we're small, and is intended to imply we work fast, especially in relation to client feedback. The other side of the small agency coin to boutique, which implies craftsmanship, a disdain for deadlines, and a few extra zeros on the invoice. In isolation, though, due partly to those pages of academic text expounding on what it means in other business contexts, it lacks a bit of credibility. Ironically, given the old features-stroke-benefits imbalance in business development, it's a benefit which could really do with having a feature to help explain what it actually looks like. If agility to your agency means not having layers of account management between the client and the creative, or being able to respond to a brief without going through a 43-stage strategic process, then say so. On the other hand, if it does mean that your creatives can save penalties, perhaps give the England manager a call before the next big footy tournament.
What has the PR industry learned from the pandemic with regards to its messaging and commercial behaviour? How did the PRCA put its entire reputation on the line to defend the PR industry's use of the internet? And how is the PR industry best placed to leverage the power of social media, influencers, and the world of virtual meetings? Now, my guest this week is considered to be a member of the PR industry's royal family. He's consistently ranked as one of the PR industry's power players, and we are very honoured to have him on the show. Oxford-educated Francis Ingham has worked at the highest levels of government and party politics. He sits on the UK Government Communications Service Strategy and Evaluation Council and leads a membership body for the UK Local Government Communicators. He was external examiner to the American University at Richmond, and he's a visiting lecturer at the University of Westminster. He's now the Director General of the PRCA, the Public Relations and Communications Association, operating out of London, Singapore, and Dubai. And for the past 7 years, he's also held the position of Chief Executive of the International Communications Consultancy Organisation, or the ICCO, operating in 66 countries across the globe. The PRCA represents over 30,000 practitioners and is the largest PR professional body in the world. The ICCO is the voice of public relations consultancies around the world. Its membership comprises 41 national trade associations, collectively representing over 3,000 PR firms. Now, as part of my preparation, and I know I do prepare, and it might not sound like it, but I do, I spoke to a few people in the PR industry, and the feedback I got was impressive, to say the least, including, he's formidable, highly intelligent, architect of the transformed PRCA, and this quote, which is lovely. Francis has played a pivotal role in the PR industry from his leadership at the PRCA for so many years now. There is no subject area or issue that he will shy away from, and he's helped alongside his invaluable PRCA team members to bring continued recognition, awareness, and credibility to the PR industry as a whole on matters ranging from PR measurement to diversity to apprenticeships and so much more. So now I feel like I've been asked to race against a Mercedes-clad Lewis Hamilton in a Trabant, but I was told, go big or go home. So let's just see how this goes. Welcome, Francis Ingham.
Keith, that's quite the intro. I will struggle to keep up with it, but I'll do my best.
Well, thank you very much, firstly, and lovely to finally get to chat to you. I trust you're in fine fettle and looking forward to getting out of your house.
I think everybody is, aren't they? I mean, it's been such a bizarre 12 months, a roller coaster of emotions, both personally, business-wise, everything. For an industry that loves to meet people and social contact, it's been a very strange period indeed. And I'm not alone in being desperate to get out, go to the pub, go to restaurants, open award ceremonies and conferences, really.
And start pressing flesh again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've lost so much during this period in terms of just interaction with people. You know, when this all began, I thought the idea of doing 2 weeks of lockdown in the UK was, draconian, remarkable, astonishing. How on earth would you get through 2 weeks of it? And now it's sort of normality of close on a year on and off. And I just want to get back to a more interactive way of living.
I agree completely agree. It's been a strange time, but it's also brought out the best of us as well, I think, in some people, and certainly in the PR industry. I've seen some great pivots and changes in business models that I think are probably here to stay for the long term. But
they are. You know, there are some positives about this period, and I'm sure we'll touch on them. But one of the things that happened really quickly was this really obvious sense of community within the industry. We held weekly calls at the PRCA, and we opened them up to anybody, members or non-members, with industry leaders, just sharing how they were getting on, trying to help one another. And, you know, they were trying to help their rivals in many cases. And that happened, I think we had 40 calls. It was quite a remarkable sense of community and of all being in this together and trying to help people out, you know. And at the end of it, we can all go back to being cutthroat competitors. But that effort to help one another through a terrible period was really obvious and very real and incredibly welcome.
And it's no fun when you can't compete against somebody, when you've got no competition.
Yeah. I hate to lose. I'm an incredibly competitive person.
But you still like to have your competitors around you rather than just completely gone. But
well, if they're completely gone, then against whom do you compete?
Exactly. Now, just a point of order here. I was thinking I must have had some kind of parapraxis, and I just always misnamed the PRCA as the Public Relations Consultants Association, but I only recently discovered that you did indeed change the name to the Public Relations and Communications Association. So, I mean, first question, what prompted the change?
Really straightforward. One of our members came to us and said, why are you called consultants? Because you're so much broader than consultants. We have 450 corporate in-house members, for example, from the government communication service at one end of things to really big corporates at the others, charities and so on. So first of all, it didn't describe what we were. But secondly, it also didn't describe the industry.
Right.
Because it has become so much broader than just PR. And the member who came to us actually had also done an analysis of names in the industry. They'd looked at the PR Week top 150 league table, and there were more agencies in it that had communications in their name than had PR. And that's, you know, so we consulted members, we changed the name, and it reflects better what we do and what the industry does.
And just for the uninitiated, I mean, can you give us just a quick potted history of the PRCA and what the vision for the future is?
Of course. So PRCA was created in 1969. It was a dining club. So we have somewhere in a warehouse somewhere in England the minutes of the first meetings and people agreeing to pay 10 guineas or something for their membership. And then it evolved from that into the consultancies in the UK, breaking away from what was then the Institute of Public Relations, the IPR, and formalising the PRCA properly. Then it became international. So there are PRCA, there's PRCA India, there's PRCA Ireland, there's PRCA Nigeria. None of them are part of the PRCA that I run. They were all set up by my predecessors because their mission was to share best practice internationally and set up fora for doing so. I took the role in 2007, just before the financial crash hit. We represented only agencies, only the big guys. We were falling apart. And we stabilised the ship. We brought in individuals, we brought in in-house, we brought in universities, And then we returned back to our original mission of international links. So setting up PRC MENA in Dubai and then Southeast Asia in Singapore. And then LATAM based out of Buenos Aires. We have our international summit coming up in a few weeks, end of March. We'll be announcing there the creation of PRCA Africa Network and the PRCA USA network. We're the largest PR association in the world. It's something I'm incredibly proud of. We run those two other organizations you mentioned, ECO or ICCO and LG Comms. Hopefully got a bit of news about running another association later on this year. And biggest association in the world. We take that responsibility seriously. It's also at times quite a lot of fun though, which is good. You've got to have some fun in your working life, haven't you?
Absolutely. But I mean, it certainly sounds like you're not holding back on sprinting forward, which is good to hear. And I mean, the PRCA's mission is basically to sort of create a more professional, ethical and prosperous PR industry. And given what's been going on recently with the pandemic and the splintering of many industries and a lot more kind of people working from home, a lot more starting their own businesses, I mean, how's the PRCA able to help small businesses and startups?
Well, I mean, you're completely right. This is really similar to a dozen years ago with the financial crash, where lots of people, either through necessity or through choice, set up their own agencies. So a load of startups all around the world, which is great because they're disruptive, innovative. They are driven by ambitious people because, after all, this is their money. How can we help them? Well, we assure people that they're dealing with that they're ethical, that they're professional. We have a whole range of services from thought leadership to training to events. I mean, last year we ran over 200 free to attend events around the world. We made lots of them available to non-members as well in that spirit of community, but the majority were member only. Those are just great fora for meeting people, exchanging thoughts and making sure you're contemporary, really. So I would always say that the really big agencies in this PR world, so the people who sit around our board, well, Edelman and Grayling and H&K and Weber and Golan and so on, honestly, they don't need us. But they have a higher, they recognize they have a higher purpose and they want an association to flourish, right, which is why they are active and they engage with us so much and they're our members. It's the little guys where we really add value in terms of professionalism, standing, finding new business, and like I say, just being in the cutting edge of the industry because it's a... it's an incredibly fast-changing one, really.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, no, I remember my old boss when in the job I had before I moved to the PRCA, he made some statement that digital is a blip and will go away. And I saw this article also in the Daily Mail. Somebody tweeted a screen grab of it from a decade or so, saying Google is on the wane, young people are stopping using the internet. And you think about that, I think, well, that was some of the most ridiculously stupid things you could possibly have said, yeah? And our industry has been completely transformed over this period.
Yeah.
The blending of disciplines, there are no lines really between PR and marketing and content and data and insight any longer. It's all blending, which is why year after year, I would say the industry grew by about 10%. 2020 is a blip, please God. but, you know, it's a really fantastic industry to be a part of.
Indeed. And I think that, I mean, just from my own sort of background as well, I mean, you know, the PR industry has always kind of managed to pull together the sort of the good elements of all man of all sort of parts of the marketing mix and to, you know, to put it into its own its own language, which I think is much more kind of communication based than it is sort of visual or anything else. But like you say, the digital industry has completely changed it. And something else, I mean, from a PR perspective and with the benefit of hindsight, and we did just touch on that before we came on air, but I mean, how do you think that the PR industry could play a sort of a greater part in the sort of communication of these key messages that a lot of us missed or we didn't get right or whatever? And so what has the PR industry learned, do you think, from the recent pandemic?
It's learned to be confident, I would say.
Right.
Because during this period when lots of organisations, whether businesses or charities or governments or universities or whatever, all when they've closed down so much of their operation, all they've had really is comms. And so this year has proved in an incredibly brutal way the absolute centrality of comms and communications to every organisation, and we can all think of the organisations that have got it right and the organisations that have got it wrong. I've said this repeatedly during this process, and including right at the beginning, I said that organisations will be judged on how they have behaved during this period. Consumers will make spending decisions about companies depending on how they behaved, or donating to charities, or interaction with governments around the world. And, you know, you've seen the chief execs who've claimed their bonuses and paid their dividends at the same time as sacking their staff. You've seen, on the other hand, the chief execs who've waived their salaries, who've responded with nuance, empathy, been human, and the same goes of government as well, obviously. And I was on a call last week with Ipsos, the polling company, and Ben Page, chief exec, and I were comparing notes about how consumers have reacted to organisations during this period. And he said there has been, in their polling, there's been a significant shift in consumers saying how they're going to buy in the future. They're looking at this period and they're making spending decisions, and, you know, far greater numbers than they were before. So it's been a seismic year in every way.
Do you mean like that they're making buying choices going forward, so the brands that they want to support based on their behavior as to how through the pandemic?
Yeah. So, for example, without naming the companies, you know, we can think of airlines.
Yep.
Some of them are just sitting on people's money and refusing to pay it back. Some of them aren't. Some of them, for example, one of the most buccaneering ones maybe, that used to say if its rivals were in financial distress, they could just go to the wall because survival of the fittest. Hmm. And then they asked for government bailouts. You know, it's all about consistency of purpose and actually being authentic, isn't it? And
yeah,
some companies and organisations have shown during this period that they are not authentic, and others have shown that they are.
It's very interesting that as Warren Buffett said, when the tide goes out, we find out who's wearing swimming trunks. You know, but you know,
I've forgotten that line. That's a good line.
I think it's been a really good test for businesses. But I mean, and conversely, I mean, from the way that companies have behaved, I mean, do you think that this has taught us about the way that people behave, given what we've all gone through?
I'm, you know, no sociologist or whatever you'd term it, but it has been a really interesting period, hasn't it? Just in terms of how people have reacted to basically having their liberty taken away from them for close on a year. So just as a personal observation, unastonished people have, by and large, followed the rules. I mean, I would struggle to think of even one person who that I know who has followed the rules 100% during this period. And plenty of agency heads I know, for example, have had immaculate hair throughout this whole period, which either means that they have fantastic partners at home who have clearly missed their calling as a hairdresser, or it means that they've been breaking the law and the guidance and having their hair done. And I know which one of those I'm going with. People have generally been, that sense of community has definitely been there, and of trying to help one another out by, I'd phrase it this way, by using one's own common sense in following the law and the guidance that's been put in front of one. So, as you mentioned, I'm on the UK Government Strategy and Evaluation Council, and throughout this period I've had weekly calls with governments. I've seen some of the data that they have been basing their communications on. And two things on that. First of all, by and large, people in the UK have followed the rules, and that's certainly been even more so the case in Singapore, Buenos Aires, Dubai, with the exception of the odd party in Dubai, of course. Secondly, the the UK government comms that I've seen has been driven by data and by insight. You know, they have reacted on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis to the polling insight and the focus group insight they've been receiving. And the comms has, in many cases, driven the government's decisions, yeah, which is something that people like you and I have talked about for a very long time, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's been, for me, it's been interesting to see how people have, right from the get-go, people wanted the government and the scientists to be 100% right. And I think that the one thing that I've taken out from all of this has been that this is it's an evolutionary process. And, you know, whatever they thought was right at the start of the pandemic, given more data and more insight and more feedback, that they've had to adjust those messages, and that people have a great resistance to, well, you told us it was to do this. You told us that we were going to have a Christmas, and now we can't have a Christmas. You know, so I that's been quite an interesting, I think, exercise for leaders to be able to say, let's not say it unless we mean it.
The other observation on that would be, of course, if you look at the polling numbers in the UK, let me phrase it this way. Nobody would say that the UK's Prime Minister has had the most even of crises over this year. It's been a bit bumpy, hasn't it? But he has a net favourability rating. He's considerably higher than the Leader of the Opposition. For disclosure purposes, I am a member of the Conservative Party, but
we won't hold that against you.
But what that says to me is it's all about delivery. And yeah, people are seeing, what is it at the moment, over 20 million people have had their first jab. So sort of voters appear to be accepting that not everything will be linear. There'll be ups and downs with it. But if you get the job done, which in case over here is about sticking needles in people's arms, then they're quite forgiving. I mean, I know you're based in the US. I think that Trump would have won re-election reasonably easily before this pandemic came along. And probably if the election were in March or April rather than November, when there's progress being made, he would have won it despite the pandemic, just because people would have seen that progress was indeed being made.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a, you know, it's been definitely a momentous moment for anybody in power as to how they managed to come through it and the public's perception of them.
Yeah, and I don't say this with any political axe to grind, but the reaction of the European Commission has been just bureaucratically pitiful, really. And you know, when you push people to a point where the Czechs are buying vaccines direct from Moscow, given, you know, the history of the post-war era, then you've achieved something quite remarkable and quite in a positive way.
Yes, it's proved a big point for a lot of people as well, I think, as it's been quite interesting. Yeah. But, you know, and I mean, again, this is all part of a learning process. I mean, nobody would have anticipated that we'd be in a pandemic, but now we have to factor, I guess, that kind of thing into all our decisions going forward. And, you know, a recent something that I saw on the PRCA website, which I thought was, which is sort of related to this. There's been a lot of talk about when this all first started, there was a lot of people saying, well, you know, one way to deal with it. And you touched on it earlier about, you know, empathy, the word empathy was sort of thrown about. But it became kind of one of the kind of big words of the pandemic. And you are the PRCA is collaborating with Empathy Week. I mean, what drove the decision to get the PRCA involved with it? And I mean, what are the kind of benefits that would bring?
I mean, one of the changes that I've seen over this period is that when somebody asks, how are you doing? You don't just say fine. And the other person says, oh, me too. People expect and get honest answers.
Right.
Which has been something I think is welcome. And I mean, I'm quite a traditional person, I suppose. I do believe in the virtue of a stiff upper lip and just shrugging off disaster and rolling along. But that is the English way, given many things. But even I welcome the fact that we care a little bit more about one another than we did without sounding all soppy, and that we actually ask about how one another might be feeling. I mean, one of the big issues, of course, that we will all have to deal with is the mental health one. And I think that's at every level. I've got four youngish children. They've had a rotten 12 months. And we, PRCA employee, we've got quite a young workforce.
Right.
It's probably reflective of the industry as a whole around the world. So it's predominantly female, predominantly young. Some of my guys have had terrible periods of stress and mental health, frankly, and they haven't hidden it, and I don't feel any need to do anything other than that as well. So when this all ends, we need to give serious... Well, first of all, we need to not go back to where we were, is the first one. And secondly, we need to really address the mental health issues in our industry, which are heavily slanted towards the more junior end of our industry, just because of the circumstances in which people have had to work and the lack of guidance in a friendly way at the beginnings of their careers.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that it took me a long time to kind of get into, because, you know, I'm at the age now where I like to be home by 9 o'clock at the latest, you know, wherever I am. So, you know, it's always been I'm at that sort of level. But obviously, speaking to people in their sort of 20s and early 30s and stuff, you know, I mean, it's their oxygen is to be out and to be sociable, and it's exactly what I was doing at that age anyway. And to suddenly suddenly have that taken away for a year, it's very hard to compute, you know, looking back, the kind of impact that that has on, you know, on people. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it is good. And it was very nice to see, because you have that, your involvement with Empathy Week, you have that very front and center on your website. And I mean, there is a lot of discussion about sort of kindness and understanding and all that sort of thing. And in the PR industry, do you think that the way that CSR was hijacked and stuff, that there is a danger that empathy is going to just become a buzzword? Or do you think that we will sort of bear it in mind, for, you know, and put it front and center of all our stuff from moving forward?
It's hard to say, isn't it? It's the honest answer. In moments of crisis, everybody says never again. And these are changes that are going to be permanent. And then they often clearly are not, you know, First World War to end all wars, for example. Didn't quite work out that way, did it? But I, and on the CSR point in particular, again, I think that it's been easy for companies to burnish their CSR credentials over the years, but this period has shown when they meant it and when they didn't mean it. The people, I mean, all I can say really is the people, the leaders I speak with do see this as a pivotal moment in history and as a moment when they become closer in one way while being also more distanced from one another.
Right.
And I do get the feeling that that sense of empathy and of concern for other people has been built in now. And I don't see it going away, but, you know, let's do a call in a year and we can judge where the industry's moved on to at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the interesting thing is that the PR industry has been, you know, has always been best placed to use the word, or to, you know, to use all the power of empathy as part of its messaging. And, you know, I think it's just a case of, you know, sort of we build it in with everything, you know, moving forward, you know, that it just becomes an ingredient that we can't live without now. But now, you touched on it earlier, and I want to steer into the world of digital, because I know you are prolific on certainly on social media, and you've been immersed in it for, you know, almost as long as you've been leading the PRCA. But for those of us who don't know how influential you've been in our digital lives, I mean, could you just briefly cover the PRCA and Meltwater case against the NLA and what the outcome meant and still means for us all now?
So, I mean, our industry relies on the media to exist, but they rely on us as well. And of course, the big fundamental change for newspapers has been the steady decline in a number of hard copies sold, the steady increase in people reading online, the mistake many of them made, with a couple of exceptions, I know the Daily Mail flourishes on it, but the mistake many of them made by giving away content for free at the beginning of this process some years ago, and the year-on-year decline in advertising revenue. So reflecting all of those things, the newspaper licensing agency, the NLA, tried to monetize online content by claiming that URLs are copyright and that therefore the sharing of them was illegal without owning a license to share. And that has fundamental consequences for our industry, because it was in effect criminalizing, albeit a civil penalty sort of criminalizing, things that we do on a daily basis when I forward a link to you or you forward one to me. So Meltwater took the NLA to court. We intervened as an interested third party and became part of the case. We lost in the Copyright Tribunal, we lost in the High Court, we lost in the Court of Appeal, and then we won at the final stage in the European Court at Luxembourg. And what it means is that it saved the industry hundreds of millions of pounds, dollars, because it meant they didn't have to buy a license to share content that was already freely available and made available by the newspapers. Now, my view on this is really straightforward. It's up to the newspapers what they put behind a firewall and what they put in front of a firewall. That is 100% their choice, and I recognise both models. But it is wrong for them to say that if I look at an article and forward it as Joe Blogs to Jemima Blogs, that's fine. If I look at it and forward it to a client, that incurs a bill or I'm breaking the law.
Right.
And that was the precedent we set in the 27 or 28 countries covered by the European Court.
It's an astonishing story, and I mean, there was I was tipped the wink to it, and sort of a while ago, and I thought that it's incredible. The thing that occurred to me about it was that had you not done that, right, had you not stepped in, right, we would be living in a very, very different world in terms of the way that we were able to send information around.
Well, we saw it as, first of all, wrong in itself. Secondly, really important for the PR industry. But more broadly, it was integral to the way society sort of works now. You know, the idea that a URL was a work of literature and therefore could be made copyright, and you would restrict who could see and forward that URL, was fundamental to the way that we live our lives now. And, you know, just it seemed to me a thoroughly bonkers proposition. The irony of it all was that when you spoke with journalists about it, they would say, well, that's mad. But it was the people who paid their salaries.
The muckety mucks, yeah.
No, if you're a journo, you want people to read your stuff, yeah?
Absolutely. you enjoy people sharing your work.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, that's interesting. Now,
when I spoke with people at the Daily Mail or the Sun, for example, I said, do you realise that the NLA, of which News UK is a member, want to stop sharing of URLs that you've made available publicly for free? They found it a ludicrous assertion.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just want to say on behalf of us all, thank you very much for all that hard work, because that was we wouldn't be living in the same world now. So congratulations on that. That's fantastic. Now, related to that, the subject of social media, and as I said before, you are a prolific tweeter, but they've been hundreds, I mean, ever since I remember from the 80s, there have been hundreds of attempts to summarise PR and to define its role, you know, from Ed Bernays to the PRSA's outsourced public relations is a strategic communications process that builds manually beneficial relationships between organisations and their publics. I mean, effectively, what we're talking about is managing the release and spread of information between an individual and its audience.
I mean, I'm sure we have some formal definition of it, but in my view, it's all about reputation management. Or to put it in a simpler way, it's about getting your point of view across.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, because of the way that social media has now kind of become such an important part of our life, you know, I mean, has that now affected the way that do you think that PR works?
We identify every year in the Eco World Report, which is our analysis of agency heads around the world, what's driving the industry forward. And every year for at least the last decade, it's been the rise of social and digital.
Right.
And it's revolutionised the way that our members operate. It's given everybody a megaphone to make their point of view known, and everybody to shout back their different point of view at that person making the first one. It's a key part of why the industry has grown. You know, double digits over the last decade. I mean, I would make this point about Bell Pottinger, and when we expelled them and the company went under. and it's not a novel observation, but it's still a valid one, that a decade before, Belpot would have survived that crisis because the newspapers would have moved on and the TV would have moved on and so on. The reason that they didn't was social media meant that they just had this storm of criticism that didn't die down. I mean, during the process of the case, I understand that a senior director in Belpot said it was a storm in a teacup, but there is no storm in a teacup in the world of Twitter.
Yeah, it's a very big teacup.
Yeah, it is.
An interesting... do you think that... related to that, are social media giants? I mean, you know, you have touched on it, obviously, with the other parts we were talking about. But should social media giants be classified as news providers?
Oh, that's above my pay grade. not least, I think a few of them are our members. to take a broader view, though, governments and society need to decide whether these giants are publishers or simply give people a voice, right? Because they just need to make that choice, in the same way that we have regulation of newspapers, predominantly self-regulation, because of the power that they have. And our industry embraces self-regulation because of the power it has. We do have these tech giants who, because of the enormity of their size, seem invulnerable to the norms that other platforms have to live up to. And we just need to use that ridiculous phrase, we need a debate about...
healthy debate.
A healthy debate about how we go forward.
Right. Okay. Because, I mean, it's quite interesting the way that I think it was just within the last 48 hours, as the announcement from Google that it's going to start paying for news in Australia. And obviously, the spat between Australian government and Facebook. I mean, it's just it has an impact on the world of PR in terms of, sort of how the messages are put out there in the public.
I mean, our key priority is, not our key priority, but it is really important to the PR industry that media are trusted, because we know our members sell in their stories to those media. They want the people reading them to believe them to be true. So it's in all of our interests that we have responsible media that reports the truth rather than, albeit with its own angle, rather than does the opposite.
Yeah, and I mean it is incumbent on us all to make sure that we do put stuff out there that has that is responsible. And I think there needs to be some kind of distinction between stuff that's just put out there by uncredited sources and stuff that's put out there by sort of authentic sources. So how we actually apply that smell test, I don't know, but like you say, that's well above my pay grade. If it's above yours, it's completely above mine. So but back to the sort of PRCA's function, and I think the thing that we first started talking about a couple of months ago was the subject of virtual training, which has become very, very sort of relevant now. And I mean, like I said at the start, you've been credited with a wholesale remodeling of the PRCA, and the organisation has now thrown its weight behind the virtual training cause. And so, I mean, what led to that one, that decision?
When all of this hit, we went overnight from being an organisation that had grown in every single year that I'd been involved with it, and membership growing every year, training revenue, events revenue, all that sort of thing, to frequently days where there was literally no money coming in.
Right.
And I would get a daily cash flow analysis And at our worst point, we're 5 weeks away from going bankrupt. And it seemed to me right at the beginning that we just needed to respond quickly. And those responses were to be as helpful as we could to the industry. So putting together those weekly calls about how to survive, for example, to giving away stuff to people who'd lost their jobs or who had lost a significant amount of their income. And so we gave away, we made 200 people members for free, for example, because they'd been made redundant. But also completely changing the and engaging with the government and giving the industry's view to government, but just changing the model completely because, you know, basically overnight we cancelled all the training courses. We were due to have an award ceremony for digital awards, quite ironically, in the first week of lockdown. And so we pivoted, to use that phrase we all used, and then we all appear to have forgotten, all of the events to go online, all of the training courses to go online. We did that within about a week. And I saw some other membership bodies who decided not to bother. And some of them still don't. I mean, there are some membership bodies I'm in contact with who have not done an event for a year.
Right.
And that is just madness, in my view. You know, people are paying you a membership fee. They expect and deserve to get something back.
You got to earn your fees, right?
And, you know, the plus side of the virtual model is our conferences are bigger than they ever have been. You know, well, I think our biggest one last year was 750 people. We have more people on training courses than we ever had. Now, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm really looking forward to going back to face-to-face events and training. Some training does not work virtually. That's certainly the case, and events lose something when you take away the physical element. But we've proved that you can run a model that is virtual, and it's made us truly international. You know, the attendees at conferences, award ceremonies, training courses, they're from all around the world, and that's great.
And is this something that you're going to keep going with, do you think?
Yeah. So what we will do is conferences, I think, work virtually. So we'll either keep them virtual or do a hybrid model. Training, loads of it works virtually. Some of it doesn't. So the bits where it doesn't, we'll do physically again. And we'll probably do lots more bespoke training where we send in a trainer just to one organisation to train up their team in a particular area. The, you know, awards, you definitely lose that.
Yes.
The human contact element.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got our DARE award, so awards that are geographically based, like Scotland, Southwest, North, and so on. They're due to take place this summer. We booked them physically. I hope they'll take place. The UK National Conference is on the Strand. It's got a terrace that overlooks the river, so I think there'll be an appetite for that. And we had an award ceremony in Dubai in December that was face-to-face. First one for a year or thereabouts. People loved it.
Yeah, yeah. And probably because it was an event to go to where they could see people again that weren't their relatives.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you know, there's a pent-up desire within the industry to get back together, as far as I see it.
That's good. That's good to hear as well. And obviously, that's going to be part of your. I mean, that's the good thing about it, I guess, is that, you know, look at what you've now done. You've got a whole load of new product development come out as a result of, you know, what other people would view, or some people might view, as a devastating sort of event to take place in the world of business. You know, it's like some people have come out, or some companies have come out of it, you know, sort of having developed new ways to earn revenue. So I wish you all the best for that.
You know, in the medium term, and it sounds callous to say it, but it's the truth. In the medium term, this COVID pandemic has strengthened the position of the PR and comms industry.
Right.
I expect, and I already see the beginnings of it, that 2021 will be the strongest year of growth the PR industry has ever experienced around the world, and that lots of the trends of being more strategic, digital, just rocketing, more PR people providing advice before decisions are taken to chief execs, all of that will stay.
Wow. And on that note, what a fantastic note to end on. But we're not quite finished yet, because now I know you get you spend a lot of your time getting involved in heavy discourse and stuff. But we wanted to you've obviously just told us what's coming up for the PRCA, and we'll put that in the show notes. But so when you're not getting involved in the world of politics and public relations, I mean, what's your kind of go-to when it comes to relaxing?
I read a lot. So history, politics, war, that sort of thing. The easygoing stuff. and I listen at the other end of the spectrum to really cheesy music. So I quite like Celine Dion, for example.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, you got a choice? One that stands out?
I also like Wagner, but definitely has a place in my heart.
Well, you've got to pick an Isolation Island track anyway. So are we going for Wagner or for Celine Dion?
Wagner, it's longer.
Okay.
Not my own.
Fantastic. And a book for the Zoom bookshelf. What would you recommend if you're into history? It doesn't have to be work wise. It can be something cultural as well.
I quite like Andrew Roberts' biog of Napoleon, but I've been a Napoleon fan all my life.
Oh.
And just for the record, he was not a short man. It's just that English feet and French feet and inches were differently measured at the time. So I just I'll take that opportunity to put that on record.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. How tall was he then?
That's a bad one. I think it was 5'7" in UK feet, which was above average at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say that's about right. Yeah, apart from that.
I mean, dodgy taste in women as well, but nobody's perfect, are they?
But that's fantastic. Well, we'll add that to our bookshelf, and the biography of Napoleon. So
by Andrew Roberts.
Yeah. Okay, that's fantastic. And finally, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. But we've invented a new part, which is what three words, where you've got to come up with three words that will define you.
Hate to lose.
Oh, love it, love it. That's fantastic. All right, well, that's going on your show notes as well. So, Francis, I'm really sorry to say I've absolutely failed to cover not even a third of the questions that I have for you. But I know you're a very busy man, and your role in the world of PR is the stuff of legend, and the whole industry owes you a huge debt of thanks for all the hard work that you do. When we're all in close quarters again, we're planning some live podcast events, so maybe you could be a guest on one of those, and I'll find a home for all my other questions as well.
I'd be delighted to, Keith. Thanks for the opportunity. It's been nice.
It just remains for me to say I've really enjoyed talking to you, and to finally get to meet you, even virtually. And I hope you find the strength to keep working on behalf of the PR industry for at least another 9 or 10 years. But thank you very much for being my guest, and I hope we can do it again soon. In the meantime, take care, stay safe, and all the very best of luck to you, Francis.
Thanks, Keith.
Now that's a hell of a way to finish an interview, walking off to Wagner. My thanks again to Francis Ingham, and I hope we do get to talk to him again soon. Don't forget, if you're a PR agency looking for new business, check out the PRCA to access all the different support services it offers to members and non-members. The PRCA has a global presence, and Francis is a global ambassador for the industry. All his contact details are in the show notes on the website at www.thefuelpodcast.com. My thanks also go to Team Fuel, Donna Smith, Matt Bullard of St. Matthew and the Prospectors, Jeremy Davies, and Matt Smith and his team of engineers at Queegee Bow Design in downtown Indianapolis, USA. So join us next time on The Fuel, the new business podcast sponsored by The Advertist, the new business development platform, research tools and data for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?